You're listening to WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and streaming live at WPKN.org. The name of this program is In Context. I'm your host, Ken McDermott-Rowe, and I'm here with my fellow host, Gus Cantavero.
Hello.
What is the role of Islam in the current wars of the United States? That's a question we're going to discuss today. And to help us understand this issue, we're joined today by my son, March McDermott-Rowe, who is In Context's military affairs contributor. You can read his blog at our website. That's incontextreport.com. March, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
The U.S. is now at war in Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Yemen, Libya, and Somalia, and is threatening war against Iran. Now, all of these are Muslim countries. Is it fair to say that this is a war against Islam?
I think not intentionally a war against Islam, in the sense that it wasn't necessarily like the Crusades, you know, plotting out the destruction of Islam. But it just happens that the Muslim countries sit on trillions of dollars worth of oil. Now, how is this perceived by the Muslims is as a war against Islam, because you have predominantly non-Muslim nations invading, bombing, breaking up predominantly Muslim countries. I mean, when you look at the case of obviously Afghanistan, Iraq, the sanctions against Iran, Libya, a lot of the foreign pressure that's been put on Egypt. You look at Yemen, foreign involvement in Yemen, Pakistan, another one obviously, Kashmir. I mean, it's very much perceived that the Western powers are waging in a sense, they compare it to the Crusades, a war against Islam. It's how they perceive it.
Well, especially since the way that the wars have been advertised to us under the George Bush presidency, the call to arms was that they hate us for our freedom. There was a lot of talk about how barbaric Islam is, and Muslims in particular, the different sects. There was a lot of misportrayal of which sect was from which region, who was at war with who. There was a lot of talk about how they just have no respect for humanity. You know, there was the illustrations of babies being kicked out of incubators by Saddam Hussein soldiers. There was, you know, all different kinds of portrayals of the Palestinian youth are being propagandized to from a very early age in their cartoons to see that Israelis and Christians are monsters that need to be exterminated. And there's just this very one-sided portrayal of Islam and Muslims in particular. And that is something that's very costly because it's a humongous population around the world, and in particular here in the United States and in Europe and in Africa. And it's something that people should really understand more rather than just take this as a blanket, as I said, call to arms to carpet bomb the entire Middle East and Northern Africa.
Well, and one of the problems I find is people tend not to understand the complexities of Islam. I mean, it's very easy to group people together. I mean, almost in the sense that during World War II, all Germans were Nazis. During uh-huh. the all Japanese were imperialists. Uh-huh. Even the Japanese that lived in America, I mean, as I'm sure some of our older listeners will remember the internment of
exactly.
you know, Japanese Americans.
Forced labor camps.
Exactly. And, you know, and then if you look towards Vietnam, all Vietnamese that were automatically communists, it's a very easy generalization psychologically
sure.
to make, because now, you know, you dehumanize your enemy. Oh, it's, you know, it's those Muslim extremists.
Mm-hmm.
And you completely discount things like whether it's sect or culture.
Uh-huh.
Or, you know, I mean, and people forget Saddam Hussein. Oh, he was a Muslim. He was a secularist. You know, he is actually, by the textbook definition, of the opposite of an extremist,
now,
technically speaking.
What sect of Islam was Iraq predominantly under Saddam Hussein?
It was predominantly – well, the country as a whole was predominantly Shia, although arguably really before the U.S. invasion, it was probably much closer to, 60-40. Shia
okay.
majority. After the U.S. invasion, that was completely turned on its head. The ruling elite, though, under Saddam was predominantly Sunni.
What are they now?
Now Iraq is virtually majority Shia.
Okay.
That had to do largely with the pogroms committed against the Sunnis by the Shia. What had happened is there had been a tremendous amount of political repression of the Shia by Saddam's regime. Now, Paul Bremer, the former U.S. Really governor, if you will, of Iraq after the U.S. invasion, came up with the idea of de-Bathification. We're going to get rid of everybody who was a member of the Ba'ath Party, you know, kind of like getting rid of everybody who was a member of the Nazi Party. Although people forget that, you know, after we invaded Germany, we didn't get rid of the Nazi Minister of Transportation or, you know, well, actually, I think we did get rid of the Minister of Transportation. But I mean the Minister of Public Works and things like that, because you can't replace a guy who's been working for the Department of Water for, you know, 20 years. But it's, you know, kind of silly. But we decided we're going to get rid of everyone who's a member of the Ba'ath Party, which all Sunnis were required to be members of the Ba'ath Party and all Shia were non-members of the Ba'ath Party. They weren't allowed to be. So we pretty much removed every Sunni from power and gave power to the really predominantly oppressed Shia, who then immediately used the opportunity to take out their aggravation on the now defunct Sunni leadership.
So I know that before, when Saddam Hussein was in control, the Catholic Church had a large mission in Iraq. As soon as he was ousted and the new Shia majority was put into place, there was a large amount of intolerance towards Christians and anybody who wasn't part of that now ruling party. Can you explain a little bit about some of the variations of tolerance or intolerance in Islam?
One of the problems, and this is, you know, something that's commonly omitted, especially whether it's by extremists or actually ironically even by non-Muslims, is the fact that the second chapter of the Quran, and I'm not precisely certain on the verses, either the third or fourth verse, says there is no compulsion in religion. It is wrong for a Muslim to force somebody else to be a non-Muslim. For a non-Muslim to become a Muslim. However, a lot of the extremist elements, particularly, you know, when they're looking to consolidate power, the Shia in Iran were – I mean not in Iran, I'm sorry, in Iraq were looking to create a new Shia Islamic state. And this meant not only purging Christians but purging Jews, purging other Muslims that they – you know, Sunnis. And this is something that's really anathema to what Islam stands for.
So it's sort of a purity of idealism, a regional purity?
In a sense, and consolidating power.
Okay.
Could you talk about what the difference is between the Shia and the Sunni?
Oh, of course. It really is a difference in a succession. Who would succeed the head of the caliphate, who would lead the Islamic State? After the death of the Prophet Muhammad, there was a series of four caliphs, or, you know, kind of kings or rulers of the Muslim world.
Okay.
And after the last one died, there was a struggle for who would rule the caliphate. And the men struggling for it were two of the grandsons of the Prophet Muhammad. After the battle with the rival caliph, the two grandsons of the Prophet Muhammad were killed. Now, this is where the divide really splits, because both the Sunnis and the Shia admire and love the grandsons of the Prophet. But the Shia then at that point diverge and say that in order to rule the Islamic State, in order to be a ruler within the Muslim world, you have to be a direct descendant of the Prophet Muhammad. The Sunnis diverge and followed a more orthodox and traditional school of thought, which was how the first four caliphs were elected, which was democratically, by majority consensus of the entire caliphate.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really where you begin to see the divergence. Now, there are small theological differences, but really what it boils down to is who is going to lead the Muslim world. And who has the right to make theological decisions, rulings on jurisprudence and things like that?
The Westerners tend to divide the Muslim world into people who are moderates and people who are fundamentalists or fanatics. Is that an intelligent way to look at the Muslim world?
It's a very two-dimensional way that a lot of the media especially, you know, there are moderates and there are extremists and that's it. In reality, the difference is between you have secularists and you have conservatives. And, you know, when we think of conservatives, we think of the woman who has her face completely covered.
Right.
Or
the burqa.
Exactly. The man who wears a galabaya, the long sort of robe. And, you know, and then we think of the secularist as, you know, the man in the suit and things like that. And then we automatically connotate that the conservative is the extremist and the terrorist and the secularist is the modernist. And, you know, the kind of the friendly one. In reality, it's actually polar opposites. Saddam, people forget, was a secularist. He drank alcohol. You know, he smoked hashish. He didn't practice the religion as of itself. He was, by all definition, a secularist and a modernist. And he's one of these, you know, he was a tyrant. And then on the other hand, you look at a conservative organization like the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, which renounced violence in the early 80s and has democratically sought an establishment of an Islamic state, not through violence. And so it's often very skewed, but it's a conception that the media loves to portray because it's very two-dimensional. It's very easy, you know.
Let's also make sure that we mention the fact that our government loves to support those more extremist types. Like Saddam Hussein was formerly a CIA assassin, hitman, who overthrew his own government and became a puppet state to create Iraq as a puppet state of the United States. And later on, when he became sort of a loose cannon, that's when we named him public enemy number one. Or two, I guess, depending on which period you're looking at. But the fact that he was a modernist but was also a tyrant was sort of that personality that we just absolutely love.
Oh, of course. I mean, the kind of the fledgling morals.
Did we make a miscalculation in our handling of this Shiite-Sunni divide in Iraq, because now we have this Shiite a majority rule, and Iran, who we are very hostile to at the moment, is the leading Shiite power?
It was a severe miscalculation. Within Orthodox Islam, if a cleric or a sheikh makes an Islamic ruling, for example, right? If I don't agree with what he says, I can say, you're nuts, I'm not going to listen to you. Like Osama bin Laden was a sheikh. If he said something that I didn't like, I didn't have to listen to him. On the other hand, within the best comparison I can think of, within the Shia world, it's very similar to Roman Catholicism in that you have the head of the religious order. It's very similar to the Pope. You have the Ayatollahs. And the Ayatollahs are the only ones qualified in the Shia doctrine to make an Islamic ruling. Now, that having been said, it means that the natural – and they're headquartered in Iran.
So they're referred to as the supreme leader.
Exactly. They are the supreme leader in the Shia world. And what they say is law.
And people need to understand the Ayatollah will choose the leader of Iran. So when we see in our press that there's been an election and that Ahmadinejad's been reelected as prime minister, that doesn't necessarily mean that his opponent was any better, because both of them were hand selected to run for that office by the Ayatollah.
Exactly. And in fact, actually, in a recent case where there was several ministers fired by Ahmadinejad, mm-hmm. the supreme leader reinstated them.
Overruled.
Exactly. And it was that de facto, he's the supreme leader. That's what goes. And because he's headquartered in Iran, this means that every Shia – and I have known a number of Shia in my time. Lebanese, actually, interestingly enough, their first affinity is with Iran. Their very first affinity is with Iran.
Uh-huh.
They are – if you talk to any other Arabs, they are Arabs. They are very strong Arabs. It's – you know, that is their first identity. For many of the Shia, their first identity is with Iran. And so by allowing the Shia to purge all the Sunnis, we now created a country that really probably wouldn't have inherently had – ties to Iran. We now pretty much created for the Iranians a vassal state.
Is the Shiite religion in a sense coextensive with Iran's power, a revival perhaps of the Persian Empire? I mean, do we see Iran's influence in the Middle East essentially the extension of and alliances with of Shiites?
It really is. I mean, when you look at the Iranian influence extends through Iraq through Syria, which is Syria's majority Sunni, but it's ruled by the al-Assad family, who are Alawites, which are a sect of the Shia, all the way to Lebanon, which has Hezbollah, which is ruled by Hezbollah, and Hezbollah is a really predominantly Shia organization. It's really the Iranians know, and whether this is something conscious or unconscious, they know they could never sell the idea of being part of a Persian Empire to Arabs. Arabs are very proud people. You could never sell an Arab on the idea of being subservient to anyone. But if you tell them you are going to be part of a Shia caliphate, the new Shia Islamic State, they almost have to, because the Ayatollah is the head of their order, they almost have to adhere to that. They almost have to accept it.
So spiritualism before nationality.
Exactly. Well, that's one of the important facets of Islam, both Sunni and Shia, is that religion is before all else. Your loyalty is to your Muslim brothers and sisters before your nationality.
Could you talk about another sect or group, a segment of Islam, the Wahhabis?
The Wahhabis, actually, they aren't per se a sect in the same sense that the Shia are, in that the Wahhabis come out of a school of thought. Sheikh Abdullah ibn al-Wahhab, and forgive me if I have the name wrong, but last name was Wahhab. He took the Sunni school of thought to a whole extreme. He said that he was returning to what he believed the fundamentals were, which was kind of very similar to the Puritans' take on Protestantism. It was the most extreme answer, the most fundamental, most literal translation of the Quran. And this was something that appealed to very tribal people. You find very few Wahhabis in places like Egypt, places like Iraq, Lebanon, Syria. You find Turkey, certainly. You find very few vestiges of Wahhabism. But it was something that appealed very strongly to tribal people. That's why it's very strong in Saudi Arabia and Afghanistan.
And this is the sect where if you're caught stealing, they cut your hands off. If you've looked at another woman, they count your eyes out, like that kind of stuff.
Well, technically, certain aspects of Sharia law, like the cutting of a hand for stealing, is in Sharia law. But most Muslim-majority countries don't implement the literal translation of Sharia law. Some do, some don't.
So where does Sharia law come from?
Sharia law is the law that's derived from the Quran. The Quran tends to be very explicit when it comes to a lot of the laws. Certain things are left for interpretation because they were meant to be interpretive. It's very harsh when it comes to things like rape, murder, stealing, things like that. When it comes to other crimes and punishments, things like drinking alcohol and whatnot, it tends to be a little more liberal on because Islam is not meant in its fundamental, in its base, it's not meant to be a harsh religion. But the Wahhabis seek to drive it towards that fundamental. I mean, they will hang people for drinking alcohol.
Is there a connection between the Wahhabis and the Taliban or Al-Qaeda?
There is, actually. The Taliban and Al-Qaeda ideologies are derived from Wahhabism. The fact is that it's something that appeals very strongly, as I mentioned earlier, to the tribal society because it bears a very strong resemblance to tribal law. Very harsh, very primitive because you're dealing with very uneducated populations.
So we're talking about Afghanistan.
Exactly, and to a degree Saudi Arabia too, because you're dealing with the Bedouin society. But in Afghanistan in particular, it holds a very strong appeal to the Afghan population because it resembles their tribal way of life. You're dealing with a population that to the vast extent cannot read. Afghanistan has something like an 80% illiteracy rate.
And that's a place without a central government. They just do not adhere to any kind of government. So if they have some kind of unifying religious doctrines that they can all obey, then that gives them some kind of sense of government, doesn't it?
It's bizarre when we look at Afghanistan because the first thing we tried to do when we invaded was we are going to instill a Western government.
You're right.
And in reality, the Afghans have never had a central government. They've never had a loyalty to a government in Kabul. The only thing that they ever unified under was the banner of Islam. Afghanistan is made up of roughly 12 to 15 different ethnicities. And those are the majority ethnicities. You have the Pashto, you have the Tajiks, you have the Persians, you have the Kazakhs, the Turkmen. I mean, I could go on and on and on. And so these entities all really dislike each other. And they will spend their times fighting each other until there's a foreign invader, and then they rally under the banner of jihad, the banner of Islam, to fight the foreign crusader invader.
Isn't the old adage for Afghanistan, the only thing they get them to stop fighting each other is an outside force?
Exactly. It was Winston Churchill, actually, who famously said, in Afghanistan, every man's hand is against the other and all against the outsider.
Exactly, exactly.
Does does nationalism sometimes trump the religious division? I'm thinking of Pakistan government's support for the Taliban in Afghanistan, as we learned from WikiLeaks.
Pakistan is what would be considered really the government are, again, secularists. They are modernists. They really fundamentally, the government does not adhere to, you know, most of the Islamic law, Islamic rulings. They actually, I mean, by the fact that they make their first loyalty to Western powers over the benefit of their own people is an immediate deviation from Islam. And so really, they back the Taliban out of a sense of survival. The government doesn't have loyalty to Islam. It doesn't have loyalty to the West. Its loyalty is to its own survival. That's why they've now adjusted fire and they've made deals with the Chinese, defense deals, trades deals to buy arms from the Chinese because they feel that – in fact, the Pakistani prime minister said that China is now Pakistan's closest friend because they're only concerned with their survival. The United States can't keep them in power anymore.
So another thing that is misrepresented is the fact that these modernist, secularist governments like Pakistan and Iran and a few others are very pro-Western and accepting of our ways of life, not necessarily our religion, but our television, our food, drinks, clothing, that type of stuff. And we could actually be very close friends and trading partners with these countries if not for the fact that we're constantly trying to play the Middle East like it's a risk board and play them off against each other to create division.
Absolutely. I mean, you look at countries. I've traveled to Egypt twice myself, a collective time of 6 months I've spent there. One thing I will definitely say is you look at the Arabs especially, but you look at the wider Muslim world, the Bosnians, the Indonesians. You look at very Western-oriented people, very modern people. I mean, people forget Islam was the religion that invented brain surgery. You know, the caliphate, the Abbasid caliphate, was the one who invented algebra. Uh-huh. Its algebra is named after its inventor, who was an Arab, Al-Jaber. Uh-huh. And so this is a very forward-looking civilization. Mm-hmm. But what the West often does is we make the mistake of backing tyrants like Hosni Mubarak. And when they oppress their own people, then this is the impression that Arabs are given of the West.
You're listening to WPKN 89.5 FM, Bridgeport, Connecticut. The name of this program is In Context, and we're talking about the role of Islam in America's global wars with March McDermott Rowe, In Context, military affairs commentator.
I think we should move on to Libya, which is one of the major issues going on right now. It is quote-unquote a kinetic military action. It's not a war. Keep that in mind, everybody. A war does not involve love bombs, and that's what we're dropping in Libya. What is the role that the Islamists are playing in the rebellion in Libya?
Well, again, another thing that people tend to forget is Gaddafi was as well a secularist. Mm-hmm. He was a little bipolar, and they kept changing his identity. He was a pan-Islamist, then he was a pan-Arabist, and then pan-Africanist, and so on and so forth. Is, you know, couldn't quite make up his mind. Mm-hmm. But he was a secularist. He actually persecuted organizations similar to Al-Qaeda.
Okay.
He was rabidly anti-fundamentalist.
Okay.
And so he was also a tyrant, so it was kind of the lesser of two evils at that stage. The rebels, though, garnered a lot of support from Islamist organizations, particularly those that have been reportedly affiliated with Al-Qaeda, because they were really the one force that was anti-Gaddafi. Mm-hmm. In Libya, there wasn't as much a secular anti-Qaddafi movement or even a conservative Islamic anti-Qaddafi movement. It was a spontaneous rebellion where there was a gap for leadership, a gap for support – or a vacuum, I'm sorry. And these organizations came in to fill it.
One of the things that I would really like to know is that the Wahhabis and the Sharia law and Al-Qaeda and these terrorist types, these fundamentalists – obviously they frequently get lumped into Muslim as a whole, you know, the Muslim world as a whole. So that everybody thinks that anyone with brown skin and a turban and a beard is probably got a bomb strapped to their chest. What does the Muslim world as a whole say amongst themselves? Because the media coverage here is very selective. But what around the world is the opinion of a fundamentalist extremist like Al-Qaeda?
Really, there's virtually no support in the rest of the Muslim world. Actually, and something the West misinterprets, the Muslim world does hearken back for the days of the Abbasid Caliphate, you know, the return to the renaissance of the Islamic civilization. But that's not what Al-Qaeda represents. And a lot of people forget that. I mean, Dick Cheney famously said that Al-Qaeda wants to restore the Islamic rule to the world, and this is going to drive us back to the Stone Age. Uh-huh. That's not what Muslims want. Muslims want a return to the days of, like I said, brain surgery, algebra, and chemistry, and the days of security and unity. And that's not what Al-Qaeda represents. They hold virtually no appeal except in tribal areas where they happen to be the guys with the guns, and you're dealing with a vastly uneducated population where this is the norm.
Because whenever you talk to somebody about, you know, terrorists, you know, the first thing they say is, these guys really believe they're going to get a bunch of virgins in heaven if they kill a non-believer. Where does that come from?
There actually, it does say in the Quran, and there are a couple different interpretations of this, but as the number I've understood it, is that a man who dies as a martyr will receive basically 71 of the beautiful women of paradise.
Uh-huh.
Or 70, I'm sorry, of the beautiful women of paradise, uh-huh. Virgins, basically. But then what classifies as a martyr? Well, Sharia law blatantly bans the killing of innocent civilians. In fact, before the Battle of Badr, which is really the first battle of the Islamic world, it was when the Meccans were attacking the Prophet Muhammad and his believers in Medina. One of the first laws that the Prophet exclaimed, which came from God, was that you shall not harm the women, you shall not harm the children, you shall not harm the elderly, the man who works in the field, you shall not cut down trees. And so a lot of this misconception—
That kind of rules out blowing up buildings and airplanes, right?
Absolutely, which is why no true Islamic fighter would do something like that. When you see some guy gives a child a hand grenade, you're often dealing with a very uneducated population. I mean, organizations like the Taliban and organizations like that, maybe they don't understand it themselves.
So really, they're going into regions with uneducated people who are borderline, even self-sufficient, and they're selling them a line. They're basically telling them, this is what God wants you to do, without showing them the verses themselves. Telling them, this is what God wants. I'm God's representative. This is what you should do for Islam.
Exactly. And that's one thing people tend to forget. The problem is not with Islam, which is another thing the media always does. You know, these terrorists say kill all unbelievers because that's what it says in the Quran. Mm-hmm. It doesn't say that. There actually is a verse that says where you see the unbeliever, you must slay him. The context of that verse is the battlefield. And the only people you're supposed to fight are unbelievers. And the only time you're supposed to fight an unbeliever is if they are waging war against you. The only war that's justifiable in Islam is a defensive war. So you have to – it's all about understanding the context and reading the rest of the verse.
Well, I can see how that could be misconstrued because we are occupying most of the countries in the Middle East. So it's almost like we've provided them the justification to defend themselves by being there.
Exactly. And one of the things we haven't done, I mean, to a great degree, we've done it in some cases. I mean, particularly in Iraq, we built schools. But you were already dealing with a very educated population. What we're just starting to learn now, and this is some pioneered by General David Petraeus, was that if you want to fight extremism, you have to fight on the education front. Okay. Because people who can read the Quran are going to understand suicide is an unforgivable sin. I shouldn't blow myself up. But if you don't do that, if you decide we're going to win this war by bombing the Afghan population to a pulp. Well, I'm going to tell you for a start, you cannot win in Afghanistan that way. The Russians had 1 million men there and they couldn't win.
Given the divisions we've talked about in the Muslim world, is there any prospect that the Muslims would unite against the United States or other outside forces?
I think it's something you're already seeing happen. I mean, you're seeing that with the Arab revolutions, and they call it the Arab Spring, but it is a Muslim revolution. It's something that's sweeping across the Islamic world. I mean, you are finding Bosniaks in Egypt supporting the people in Tahrir Square. You are finding Chechens in Syria. I mean, it's the Muslim world is being united because they're seeing that the West backed people like Gaddafi. I mean, not like Gaddafi, I'm sorry, like Hosni Mubarak. People like al-Assad was backed by Russia.
Well, at times we have backed Gaddafi. You know, he was recipient of some loans during the bailout from the Federal Reserve. So there have been selective times when even our enemies have been supported.
Well, that's true. Oh, and we did back Saddam at one stage, too.
Of course, yeah.
So there is a strong sense in the Muslim world that the West is not to be trusted. The West will betray us because their way of thinking is that the West is going to do what's expedient for it. You know, backing Hosni Mubarak, who's murdering his own people, sends the wrong message.
I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there. Thanks very much for being with us tonight,
yes,
March.
Thank you, March, very much.
You've been listening to In Context on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut. I'm here with my fellow host, Gus Tantavero, and our guest tonight has been March McDermott Rowe, In Context Military Affairs contributor, and we've been talking about the role of Islam in the U.S. global wars. Please join us on Sunday, August 7th, when we'll be back here at 10 p.m. That's Sunday, August the 7th.
And don't forget about our website at incontextreport.com, where you can read the blog and download the podcast.
Thanks very much.
See you next time.